Good afternoon. It is 12:02, Monday morning or Monday afternoon now, and you know what that means. Let me hear the trademark.
Woohoo!
There you go. Police Chief Dean Rondo here, Wolfboro Police Department. Thanks again for coming in today. Appreciate
it. Oh, my
it.
Pleasure.
We didn't talk last week, so let me get your opinion on the Chauvin verdict. I don't understand how somebody can be convicted of three separate charges for one crime. I'm a little funny on that one.
So the first thing, let's take it step by step. So I honestly think the jury arrived at the right decision.
Yeah, I think they got it right.
Without doubt. We'll talk about that here in a minute. Were there mitigating circumstances? Yes, there were. But at the end of the day, you can't do what he did. And the big issue was he prevented the medical help from treating a man in distress. Right? You can't do that either. So there were exacerbating circumstances here, too, on both sides, right, and mitigating and exacerbating. But, no, the jury got it right, and I was happy to see that. I don't know the laws in the state of Minnesota, so I don't know how they are going to deal with the lesser-included. All right, so let me talk about what the theory of lesser-included crimes. So when you have various crimes. A good one in New Hampshire is reckless operation of a motor vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Reckless doesn't happen all by itself. There are other violations of law that build up to reckless. So there might be speed, there might be stop sign violations, red light violations. So, well, usually the theory is three or more minor or lesser included violations add, make up, become reckless operation, right? If that makes you understand a little bit better. So with first-degree murder, you've got second-degree murder, you got manslaughter, you might even have negligent homicide, right? Each one of those crimes has a lesser-included offense attached to it. So, and they're different culpable states of mind. We've spoken about culpable states of mind before. So with first-degree murder, it's premeditated, right? So that's really hard. I mean, it's hard to... So here's what I believe they did, the prosecution did, and it was the right thing to do. They charged him with what they thought he did, which is what you do, right? And what you believe you can prove, right? That's definitely what you do. In this particular case, they thought they had enough to prove. And I didn't watch the trials, okay?
Right, I didn't either.
I didn't watch the trials. I was working. I couldn't. But they charge him with first-degree murder, right? So they have to show purpose, okay? So that purpose really requires a long thought out intent, right? This didn't happen accidentally, so to speak. He was just gonna murder him, right? And he made a mental thought process, a mental construct in his mind that he was going to kill this man. Okay, so that's what purposeful means, right? There's a mental construct, and you make a decision to do X, Y, or Z. Okay.
Right.
Now, there could have been, and we do this too in the Wolfboro PD when we charge a case at the misdemeanor level, right? We will charge all the lesser included offenses we can, because you never know what the judge is going to do. So the judge may say, hey, Chief Rondo, you did a great job of proving speed, and you did a great job of proving stoplight violation and stop sign violation, but you're not really there for, and I'll give you negligent driving, but you're not really there for reckless operation. Okay, Your Honor. That's the judge's decision. The judge gets to weigh the evidence and say, I think you arrived at second degree murder, but not first degree murder. Mm-hmm. Or I think you arrived at manslaughter. So And not second-degree murder, first-degree murder. So you charge the primary offense that you want. You want the first-degree murder because that carries the most severest penalties. And then you charge, you also, because theoretically, right along the way, if you're going to try to prove first degree murder, you're going to have to prove manslaughter, you're going to have to prove second degree,
right?
You know, or negligent homicide and second degree murder, so forth and so on, right? You're going to have to work up the ladder, so to speak, theoretically. And maybe if you take that approach, you say, okay, here are the crimes, the three or four crimes that I think I have. If you take that approach, it's just like trying to study for that very hard math exam, right? You may not get 100, but you got 95, or you get 98.
See, I thought they could only find him guilty of one.
It doesn't work that way. Well, it can work that way if you only charge him with one, but they charge him with multiple. I would have done the same thing. I would have charged multiple offenses, and those are called alternate theories.
Oh, right. No, I understand lesser-included offenses.
Those are called alternate theories, lesser-included offenses, and the judge could have very easily said, well, I don't think the prosecution did arrive at first-degree murder, but you definitely have second-degree murder, so I find you guilty of second-degree murder, right? That could happen. And so that's why they did it. Now, does it mean he's going to get any more time necessarily? No, I don't think so. I think what's going to happen is they're going to everything will be wrapped up in a one big sentence.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
It does.
I know what you're thinking. It's not double jeopardy.
See, I didn't actually think that. But what I thought is you can only be sentenced for one crime at a time.
He will be, yeah.
So the fact that he was convicted of second Minnesota, obviously, has a third-degree murder charge, which I don't understand.
I don't know what that is.
Right. And there was a second-degree manslaughter charge.
Yeah, I don't know what that is.
I mean, there's only one crime here. You can only sentence him once. At least that's the way I look at it.
And I think he will be sentenced once. I just don't know sentencing laws. I don't know Minnesota law, so I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know what a sentence will be.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how that's going to work. I'm sure whatever it is, it'll be constitutional. I don't think that they're going to. I don't think the DA or the prosecuting attorney, county attorney, is going to let an unconstitutional sentence stand.
No,
it wouldn't be in their best interest to do so.
No, they don't want it overturned.
However, there are some politicians that made really rabid statements, and that I can definitely see, and I think the judge is absolutely right. I definitely can see that being grounds for appeal. This is the reason you can't, if you're a prominent politician, you can't do this type of stuff. And it was really dumb. I can't emphasize how dumb that was, because anybody who knew anything about the Chauvin case wanted him found guilty, right? They wanted him found guilty of murder, okay? And that's what happened. And, you know, so hold that thought. When I'm out there doing cases, working cases or overseeing cases that I do now, whatever the case may be, we want to, oftentimes, we take time and we do these cases very methodically, and we have meetings about which way we should go, and we spitball all the issues and we talk the issues through, right? And this is what leaders do in a police department. The reason we do that is we're taking arguments away from defense counsel, right? That's what you want to do. You want to limit those arguments, right? There's a lot of strategy here. Because you want the best outcome. It's all about outcomes. You want good outcomes. It's all about outcomes. Everything we do is based on is outcomes. That's what you want. You want good outcomes, excellent outcomes. And that was so dumb. You know, the various politicians talking about and threatening violence and riot and because now what happens is you have the juries and. So here's how the case is going to get, in my opinion, get challenged on appeal. And you'll see this go to the Supreme Court. They're going to get, you know, juror number 6 or 7 or 8 or whatever, and they'll bring all of the jurors in, and they'll say, were you in fear of your life? Would you have been in fear of your life if you had voted not guilty? And I guarantee at least one of those jurors is going to say yes. And I was worried about what would happen and the rioting and this and that. And that's all it's going to take. That is all it's going to take. And because the system that we have in the United States is really dependent upon our peers, right? You have a trial in front of a jury of your peers, and if they're afraid to vote on the evidence because of what may happen in their personal or private lives, their house be burned down, or they be attacked, or their family be attacked, the system is been compromised. And that was incredibly dumb, that thing that happened, and I'm not even going to mention that politician's name, was dumb. It was just dumb, because it just gives defense counsel, in my opinion, a very strong argument. Alan Dershowitz said the same thing. He said the same thing. When Alan, it was funny, when Alan Dershowitz and I are on the same sheet of music, you better listen.
You know, I was just thinking about that, that I don't think you guys agree too often.
No, but when we do, we're and I like Alan Dershowitz. I at some point in time, I hope I get to meet him. He's a fantastic, unbelievable,
one of the
world's
great legal minds. Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
And of course, is a law professor at Harvard, or was a law professor at Harvard, my old stomping grounds down there in Cambridge, Mass. But a very brilliant man. And as soon as that came out, I said, "You got to be kidding me! I can't believe that comment was said." Oh. Yeah, so any event, and that's the problem, you know, but in any event, at least Mr. Chauvin was found guilty, and
for now,
you know, we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens.
Well, okay.
You know, time will tell, right?
12:14. Thank you for listening. It is Eric Scott along with the Wolfboro Police Chief, Dean Rondo, 569 Lake. If you want to join the conversation, feel free to do that, 569-5253. Also, since we last talked, there was the use of force incident. The officer, 26-year officer, thought she had a taser, and it was her handgun.
That's tragic.
Not passing judgment because I wasn't there, but that's... They don't get any more tragic than that.
No, they don't. That was tragic. That should have never happened. And, you know,
And she's looking at charges now.
Of course. Oh, yeah. So, you know, yeah. Yeah, hopefully they'll let her plead that one out.
I hope so.
Because, I mean... So the taser, I'm wearing a taser. Taser's a cross draw.
Right. I was just, notice the taser's on your non-dominant hand.
Yes, it's a cross draw. And I don't know. You know, clearly, you know, there are training issues there. It's too bad. You know, we're Monday night quarterbacking this thing, and I hate to do that.
Right.
That was a terrible situation. Yeah, but, that one is, that is a tragic. They're all tragic, right? They're all tragic. That was.
It's funny. I had this discussion a couple of days ago with a friend of mine, who says that the taser is defective as designed because you can mistake it for a handgun. Now, I own a taser. I used to drive for Uber, and they wouldn't allow me to carry a handgun.
You gotta have, there's a flip switch on a taser.
Right. There's a safety, just like there is on a gun. Plus the fact that you have a laser sight and a flashlight.
Yeah, it's a whole different process. It's a whole different process.
How can you confuse those two?
Yeah, it's a whole different process. So, like I said, there are some training issues here. Plus, you know, here's the other thing. This is not even a good use of force. This is not even a good use of force. Right? So, I have problems with this one all day long. And we'll just end it there.
I understand.
Yeah, well, there are training issues all over the map on this one. I don't know what she's been doing for 26 years, but I don't want to be my
right.
quarterback.
Right? And that's what leads me to think.
We'll let the court system deal with this one. This one is destined for, I think this is destined for a guilty finding.
Well, we'll.
I don't think there's going to be any mystery here.
I don't know, but hopefully she'll plead this out and get it, rather than put the country through all of this all over again.
Right.
But we'll see what happens. Now, what would happen if there was a use of force here in Wolfboro? I've heard this again. Now that Cops is back on, and I've been watching it on the Reels channel. By the way, those of you who are missing it, yeah, it's on from 5 to 7 every weekday afternoon. Anyway, I hear sometimes when there's a taser or whatever, they'll call for a supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess kind of makes sense, and that's part of the rule book.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
hopefully there's a supervisor on scene. But
so let's walk it through. One of your officers has a use of force. Let's say has to deploy a taser.
So we do in every use of force, even if it's putting down an animal, right? Where a shotgun is used, for example. You know, a deer gets hit and it wanders off in the woods. You got to track the deer down, and you shoot it. We do. There's a use of force report. We fill out a use of force report. It's reviewed by a supervisor, either approved or disapproved.
And if it's disapproved, what happens next?
Well, if it's disapproved, there's usually probably going to be some disciplinary action that goes along with that, commensurate with the use of force. And along with that disciplinary action may come some additional training.
Okay. And if it's approved, of course, that's the end of the matter.
But part of the report.
Right. Okay. Do you get many?
No. No, we don't. And to be quite honest with you, you know, people around here are fairly compliant. You know, do we have to go hands-on with somebody? Yeah, occasionally.
But it's rare.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd say it's rare. But we do, I mean, if people do resist arrest and people do resist arrest or if they fight, you know, they get charged with that as well, right? There are consequences to bad actions.
Well, as there should be.
Mm.
One of the things I noticed on Cops is when they arrest somebody, they take their hands and it's a particular hold that they're using so they can handcuff them.
There's a number of those. That's all part of defensive tactics. There's a number of different holds
you
and
put
moves.
Your hands together, and it's almost like a, I don't know.
They're using pressure points.
Is that what they're called?
Yeah, they're using the pressure points to gain compliance, to make sure you don't resist.
Okay.
That's what you want.
And then obviously if then you can feel resistance start, somebody tenses up or whatever, you can decide to do what you...
That's correct. So we go through a lot of what is called defensive tactics maneuvers, and these are all designed to gain compliance very quickly so we don't have these things escalating on the street. You don't want that.
That makes sense.
Yep.
1220 on WASR. Thank you very much for listening today. Of course, we're talking with Dean Rondo. I don't know. Do you think that as a rule, where police officers are using more force, or
no?
Okay, or are we just hearing about it more?
No, you're hearing about it more. We're in the age of technology. Everybody's got a cell phone with a camera on it, so we're hearing about it more, right? You're seeing it. You're seeing, you know, video cameras where there were none. Okay, and so, I mean, think of it, you know, think of the old Western days, right, where everybody had a six-shooter and people were dropping dead in the street every day. So, it's not happening more per capita of the population. I hate to say it like this, but we've always been this violent, right? You go back 10 years ago, some countries in Europe were issuing warnings of going to the United States, please try not to get killed. Right. And you know, those are true statements. That's just fact. Okay, we have a gun culture in this in the United States. We're a very violent culture, and you see that being acted out in this country every day. You don't see these same things happening in a lot of European countries because they don't, because they have a different culture. Interesting story. This was when I was in the Army. We were finishing up. I was a major at the time. I had a team. I was leading a team, and we were in civilian clothes, and there was a couple of days left in Germany before we rotated back to the United States. And this is like late fall, right around Oktoberfest time, and we were at a a brujas, right, a beer house, which is where you go to get a nice meal and good German beer. And so we're at this brujas getting dinner, and I love schnitzel, all right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Me too.
Oh, that's just some good stuff, right?
There's a place in Peabody, yeah. Mass. That makes it.
Oh, anyway.
Carl's Sausage Kitchen.
Yeah, this one came with an egg on top. I was,
man. You got to have the egg on
top. Yeah, but just add more cholesterol, cholesterol. So anyway, so I got my guys there, and we're having a good time. Again, we're all in civilian clothes, and there were some American GIs, not part of our exercise or anything else, just over in the corner, and they're getting loud, and of course, I'm the adult supervision here. I think it was maybe about 38 or 35 at the time, and watching these guys act out, and some of the German bouncers there in the brewhaus, right, did come over, owners or whatever. And there's a little scuffle begins, and one of my sergeants stands up, and I said, "Sit down. Sit down." And he sits down. He says, "Sir, they're Americans again." Watch. And about 30 seconds later, in come the Polizei, the German Polizei. Now, I don't know if many people listening have any experiences in Germany, but Germans happen to be very big people. They're very big, okay? All the Scandinavian peoples are very big. Right, very big. In fact, I'm a runt over there, okay? I am a runt. And here come these guys, and they're like 6'2", 6'3", 240 pounds. And there's a whole pile of them come right through the door. And the nightsticks come out, and all of a sudden, everybody's getting a Maglite shampoo, okay? and these guys get busted up six ways to Sunday. They get hauled off and thrown in the... And we're like, hey, we're just eating our schnitzel over here. Everything is cool. And one of my sergeants said, "Hey, sir, what's going to happen?" I said, "Let me tell you what's going to happen." They just busted them all up, and they put them in the back of the paddy wagon, threw them all on top of each other. They're going to take them to the first military post they find, Air Force, Army, Navy, whatever, and they're going to open up the back door. They're going to throw them out at the MPs, and they're going to drive off. That's exactly what's going to happen. And so over there, they don't play. Right, the Germans definitely don't play. Right, they are and now Germany is a very interesting culture because it's all rule based. The Germans are huge on rules. Nobody violates the rules. You just don't do it, okay? And when you do it, there are really bad consequences, really bad consequences, and hence what happened in the brewhaus. Now this is in 1997, 1998 time frame. So. In the United States, we forget that, we had the Wild Wild West, and we just grew up with guns and we grew up with violence, and that's part of the culture of the United States. That's why this is really a difficult issue to deal with. How do you rein that in? And it's got to be inculcated approach. We have to try to rein this in across the culture. And because you're bumping up against the Second Amendment.
Well, and that's true. And how do you change a culture that's so ingrained?
Right.
I don't think you and I will be alive to see it if it ever happens at all.
This is quite honestly. So how do you change any culture? I'll tell you. First of all, forget trying to repeal the Second Amendment. That's just a dumb idea.
Right. That's
off the table. Don't even discuss that. That's just goofy, right? Don't try to, when you start bumping up against this, so let's just talk this out real quick, because I'll tell you how you do it. When you start bumping up against the Second Amendment, right? Well, we're going to limit high capacity magazines and that. No, okay. Sure, you can try all you want. That's a waste of air. Don't do that. Don't, because you're dealing with those 26 words in the Second Amendment, right? And the right to bear arms shall not be infringed, right?
Right.
So you've got to get around. You got to get around that paragraph, and that's really, really hard to do.
I agree.
So So the best way to change culture is you start in third and fourth grade. Okay, and you got to change culture that way. And you got it's got to be an inculcated approach. You just can't do it once and say, okay, I did it. No, you got to do it again in sixth grade and seventh grade and eighth grade and high school and, you know, freshman, sophomore, junior, senior year and in college. And it's got to be inculcated because and it's going to take about 100 years. And that's how you do it. Okay, you got to change. You got to change the culture. You got to change behavior. Okay. So this culture of violence has to end, and that means that parents need to parent correctly. Okay, now there are other issues that we have to deal with. You know, undiagnosed mental health—that's a huge issue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Are there things we can do to better keep the firearms and deadly weapons out of the hands of dangerous people? Sure, we can do background checks and they can be denied and so forth and so on. Sure, all that is helpful. Right. But nothing, you know, you can't look at that as the only thing. This has got to be a multifaceted approach.
Right.
You have to have very, very comprehensive legislation. But a lot of this is cultural and a lot of this deals with mental instability and mental health issues and depression. You know, I think there is some merit in red flag laws that, you know, would be, hey, Dean Rondeau is not acting right. You know, maybe we should take his guns type of thing. You know, that could be, you could craft some sort of legislation if a judge approves it, his weapons are taken from him for 90 days and be issued back to him upon a hearing, so forth and so on. There is a number of different things. So here's the thing with rights, right? Now I am an Alexander Hamilton type of guy, meaning that, you know, my political philosophies are very much like Alexander Hamilton's. And I do not look at, now some others look just the opposite, right? They're more Jeffersonian, right? Where rights come from God and your rights are absolute. So the rights of individuals in society are not absolute. Okay?
Right. Okay.
Are not absolute. Okay. They can be restricted. But the way they are restricted is not across the breadth of society, like, let's take away everybody's guns, right? No, you don't do that. But an individual who shows an inability to, you know, comport with a rule or regulation requirement, his or her rights can be suspended or they can be limited, right? We do it now, right? DWI, right? Great example, right? Someone's going to say, well, that's a privilege and not a right. So, I get it. But it's a good example, right? If somebody commits the offense of DWI, their license is suspended. Now, maybe that's a bad example because that's driving is a privilege, not a right. But the right to vote can be suspended for a period of time if you're in prison, if you're a felony, if you're convicted of...
Or hunting.
You know,
they can suspend your hunting license if you get a violation.
So the point is that, you know, if a person is deemed to be a threat to society, in order to secure society, I believe that we can limit their individual right to that would allow them to cause harm if they can't practice that right in a responsible fashion. And I think that's where we need to focus, right? That's where we need to focus our energy. But bumping up against the Second Amendment, you know, that's just wasted space. That's a waste of energy. That's never because, you know, that is you're trying to change a constitutional amendment, and not just any constitutional amendment. Number two on the list, right? And you get some will say, well, number two guarantees number one.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there is, I guess, supposedly there is some of that. But listen, our founding fathers were very smart men. And they did things for a reason. And there's a real reason that we have the First Amendment as number one and the Second Amendment as number two. Okay.
While I've got you sitting here, let's talk a little bit about what's coming up in town as the weather gets warmer and the amount of out-of-state plates gets greater and greater and greater. even though it seems to be more now than I've ever seen it in this time of year.
Well, that's because of COVID-19.
Yeah.
People are escaping the big cities and coming up here.
I noticed the speed limit sign was out on Friday.
Yep, the speed limit signs are out. The radar sign, radar warning trailer is out. It's been deployed.
Now, here's a question. It tells you what your speed is.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there a way for it to remember what people's speed is? Because I can see that being rather valuable information.
Oh, you're right. Absolutely. Yeah. So those signs. So here, this is the cool part, right? You're going to go, wow. So the radar warning trailer and all of our signs work off this same software package that we have. Okay. And those signs talk to us every day. They send us every day. They send us probably at this point thousands of messages about who's speeding where. And when I say who, a vehicle is speeding, not Eric Scott is speeding on Sewell Road. It doesn't do that. It can't do that. But it'll tell us a vehicle is speeding on Sewell Road. It'll tell us when and where. It'll tell us the speed. And over a period of, and the signs are intelligent signs in that they know exactly where they are on the map, right? There's a GPS in it, right? So when it's programmed, we tell the sign, hey, you know, you're at the corner of Walk and Don't Walk on Sewell Road. And it will say, yes, I know I'm at the corner of Walk and Don't Walk. And it'll bring up a little map and it'll put its pin there. So we know where these signs are deployed, and we know if they're operational or not. We know if the battery needs, if it's not charged or charging or whatever. We know if there's an issue. And we can see all that data. We can see the data of vehicles, what they're doing, how fast they're going, so forth and so on. Yeah, we can see all that.
And you mine that data for what?
So it's a matter of efficiency, right? So let me give you a good example. Somebody calls up from, you know, and I'm just making this one up, 109 East. Oh, my God, Chief, I need you to get your guys out here. You know, they're speeding all over the place. They're going 100 miles an hour. 100 miles an hour, Chief. Yeah, that's too fast on this road. 100 miles an hour. Get your people out here. And I get that all the time, right? Okay, fine. So we'll put a sign out there, you know, or maybe we'll put two, you know, capture both lanes of traffic. And we'll find out, you know, between 6 and 6:40, you know, they're going about 10 miles over the posted speed limit, right? And so we'll maybe do that for a while and see if the speeds come down. If the speeds come down, great. If the speeds don't come down, then we'll put a unit out there and start writing tickets. It really is that simple. But what it does is take the original complaint that came in. Oh, my God, Chief, they're speeding all the time. Oh, my God, this is unconscionable. So 24 hours in a day is a long time, right? I don't have that many officers. But I can get a guy out there or a girl out there from 6 to 6:40. I can do that. So you see what I'm saying? It's efficiency.
Right.
It helps me narrow in on a problem. And it tells me what the speeds are. And maybe when we put the signs out there, because I do it myself, right? I see, you know, I'm in another jurisdiction or even our own jurisdiction, and I see the signs flashes. Whoa! You know, and I hit the brake and drop it down, right? I do the responsible thing. 9 drives out of 10 do the responsible thing.
Slow down, right?
Yeah, bring it under that speed limit. I've seen it in my personal vehicle.
I do it myself all the time, and even though I know there's not like there's a police officer hiding on the other side of the sign, you do it anyway.
Right, but the other cool thing is, right, and this happened today. So right before the show, I was out on patrol. It's something I like to do. I like to get out there for two and a half hours, and I'm coming up on College Road, and I see the sign on 28. And I see this car coming down, and I look at the sign because it's right there. So I can see it, too, although I'm coming up from College Road, and I see him doing 53. And he sees the sign, goes, woo, slows right down. He didn't slow down because of me, because he couldn't see me. He had already passed me.
Right.
He saw the sign. But that's a good thing, too. If he had been speeding, I'd have put the blues on, and come on, that's an easy ticket. Come on, Eric. That's a keeper. We're reeling that one in. Yeah. And that happened. Folks, I'm just joking. Come on now. But that happens a lot, actually.
Okay. Yeah. 12:37, of course, if you have any questions or comments, 569-5253. So what changes here in the police department as the summer gets closer and closer?
So the dynamic. So we're busy all the time.
Right.
Right. I mean, the Wolfboro PD.
But you don't add people for the summer.
No, we don't. Well, not necessarily. But the dynamic of what we do changes. So, for example, I just got an electric mountain bike. That's really exciting. So we're going to be able to push out a lot further. That electric mountain bike gets up to 35 miles an hour.
Wow.
Yeah. So we'll be able to have a lot more visibility, get punched further out, if you will, along the Bridge Falls Path and the Rails to Trails. There were problems this year, last year, out on the Rails to Trails. We you know, so we're hoping to get some of that reined in. It's just quality of life issues, nothing. You know, it's nothing too serious, but it's quality of life issues, and we take those seriously because we want everybody to have a good quality of life. But we'll be in and around downtown. You'll see a lot more foot patrols. The highway safety grants will be kicking in, so you see extra DWI and speed patrols out. So it's the nature of the activity. We're gearing up for the busy tourist season.
Okay. You don't necessarily... I mean, you watch things like Laconia Bike Week or Sturgis or Mardi Gras or anything like that. Now, granted, that's not Wolfboro.
Mm. But, thank God.
Yeah. I don't know where we'd put everybody. But, I mean, it gets very, very crowded in here.
It does, yeah. You know? During the summertime, we have sustained population densities of 14,000 and up, sustained throughout the summer. That's a lot. We're more than doubling our population density in the summertime, and it really does stay that way. And the comment you made, I see a lot of out-of-state plates. Look, COVID-19, we saw everybody open up their second and third homes here in Wolfboro because it was safe. It was a lot safer to live in Wolfboro than it was New York City, Pennsylvania. So we've had higher-than-normal population densities. A lot of these people just stayed at home and didn't venture out because they didn't want to get sick. But, yeah, you're right. And, you know, I think the summer's going to be good. I think it's going to be very busy. Hopefully we're coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic. Time will tell.
I'd like to think so.
Yeah, we all would. But we don't want to be too careful too soon, and we don't want to let down our guard too soon. This is everything I'm reading about this virus, and I'm a voracious reader. Everything I'm reading about this virus and there's a growing body of evidence now. I've heard some virologists call it an intelligent virus. It seeks to infect. It seeks ways to infect and avoid the body's immunization system. It's very insidious. There's a growing body of evidence to suggest some of these super spreader variants are actually more deadly, more contagious than the original coronavirus version. So time will tell.
Well, that would kind of make sense if you look at natural evolution. The hardier viruses are the ones that would survive.
That's
right. Just like anything else.
Well, I'm one of those, and don't call me a conspiracy theorist now, but I'm just an intelligence officer from the Army. I look to connect the dots, and I think this virus was designed.
You do?
I do, yeah. Yeah, I don't think there's any mystery here at all. I've been saying this almost from day one. There's nothing in the historical record that would have suggested this virus was in existence before. Nothing. So that's what I think. I think this got out of a lab. I'm just not sure how. I suspect it may have been. My own personal opinion is that it probably got out because of poor handling procedures and characteristics at whatever lab this got out of. But there's no doubt in my mind.
Well, let's follow that up for a minute.
Sure.
If it was created, and I'm not sure I agree with you, but let's just say that it was. If you were going to create a virus, wouldn't you create something a little more lethal than this?
Well, so maybe, maybe not. So let's talk about that. So from the scientific, let's just make sure we define a couple of things here. First of all, you have military labs that create viruses for military effect.
Right.
Right? And then you have civilian labs that create viruses or mutate viruses so they can study the effects of medicine on those viruses so they can come up with better drugs and treatment strategies for people that that may get sick. All right. So the coronavirus is a family of viruses that, in fact, it causes the common cold. Okay, that's a coronavirus. Right. That's a type of coronavirus. So it is not inconceivable to me to think that a lab somewhere may have been designing a virus to come up with treatments and treatment strategies should the coronavirus mutate and go in a particular direction. I think, my personal opinion is, I think that virus got out the back door somehow. Either an infected specimen was sold, an infected specimen escaped, or a vial was dropped and broke in the lab and was cleaned up, but maybe perhaps not cleaned up and disinfected the proper way, and then escaped out with that lab worker on his clothing or her clothing, whatever the case may be. Now, with the military, right, one of the things that you would want to do let's look at World War I for this example, right? Okay. The Germans used a lot of mustard gas, right? Mm-hmm. Was ammonium chloride, and that was a really effective weapon. Mustard gas, right? That's called mustard gas, right? Mm-hmm. And that was a very effective weapon.
Yeah, put Hitler in the hospital.
It sent everybody to the hospital. So here's what happens: you overload the logistics system. Okay. So when you create mass illness, okay, you're overloading an adversary's logistics system to the point where the hospitals are overflowing. The trucks are no longer carrying beans and bullets and gasoline. They're carrying drugs and bandages and medical supplies, right? And the priority traffic now shifts from you know, war fighting to health. And so you start clogging down your supply lines with medical convoys and transportation assets as opposed to military maneuver assets. So the point I'm getting at is, either way, if this virus was designed to kill or make ill, it did its job, right? Because look at what it did to this country. It shut it down. It shut down
most of the world down.
It shut down, as you're getting ready to say, it shut down Europe. Okay, it shut it down. So it did what it was supposed to do. So if it was a military designed virus, that's what you want, right? If you're in a global war, especially if you're in an economic war, okay. Remember, it's all about economics.
Especially with China.
You want to get to the top of the food chain. So you want to position yourself, and it would have been the perfect time. I hate to say it like that, but look at what was happening with China at that time. You know, President Trump was in office. We had the tariffs against China. Their economy was in a shambles. This was a reset. This reset the world economy.
Well, I mean, and so many sea changes went through. Like, for instance, they're no longer buying our recycled plastic. And we're stuck with it.
Well,
you know, price of recyclables has plummeted.
The other thing is, look who manufactures, or at least at that time, look who manufactured all of our pharmaceuticals.
China and India, for the most part, are large manufacturers.
Yeah. So I think there were some strategic lessons learned here. You know, maybe we should have certain pharmaceutical manufacturing and industry in the United States. Maybe we shouldn't farm that out to other countries, right? I'm just saying. I don't think it's wise to put all of our pharmaceutical manufacturing in the hands of one or two countries. India right now is the virus is exploding.
Oh,
in
I
India.
Know. I was reading about that yesterday.
And
oh my God!
The reason why the coronavirus or COVID-19, whatever you want to call it, the reason why it didn't do so well here in the North Country in New Hampshire is because we're rural. The more rural you are, the safer you have a tendency to be, because the virus needs that population density to expand. And if it doesn't have it, sure, people get sick. But then if they can't transmit it, the virus dies.
Right.
So it needs the human, the human bodies. In India, they're living literally on top of each other. New York City, they're living on top of each other. Pennsylvania, yeah, they're living on top. Or Philadelphia, they're living on top of each other. So the major population densities, the cities, got the worst of it. New York is still having a devil of a time. But the further north you get, or the sunnier it is, because the virus does not do well in the sun.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it did something about the ultraviolet radiation.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Reminds me of that Star Trek episode. You know the one where,
yes, I know the
where
one.
Spock was infected?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So any event, but yeah, there's a lot. I don't want to make anybody conspiracy theorists now, but I'm just saying there's a growing body of evidence to suggest that this came from a laboratory. The former head of the CDC has said 40 years of virology. He believes, Dr. I think, Redfield, he said there's no doubt in his mind. There's another doctor, Metzl, who's actually... a virologist with the World Health Organization. He's a Harvard and Brown University trained virologist who's saying the same thing. That, and he's pushing the WHO to not take the guided tour, so to speak, from China, and saying you need to do, China needs to open up their records. They need to allow access of, you know, for us to interview their scientists, unfettered access. And China was saying, no, you don't get that. And, you know, I'm like, well, why would you say no? If this is indeed a worldwide pandemic and there may be some answers here, I think the world is owed an explanation. And that's just my – so everything that China is doing is very suspicious to me. And I think Dr. Metzl and Dr. Redfield are absolutely correct. I think that – and I'll tell you right now, there's no – you know, Dr. Metzl is not – you know, he has no agenda here at all. He is a – you know, he's on the WHO, and he's pushing the WHO really hard. And he was the author of a letter a number of scientists, prominent scientists, signed on that want the WHO to put more pressure on China. But – in any event, see what happens.
I'm not a political scientist by any stretch of the imagination, but you can see China is a bit more of an authoritative state than the United States.
Oh, it's a communist state.
Yeah, and well,
no, they're a communist state.
It's a modified communism.
Well, sure, you can call it whatever you want. I mean, look at Huawei, right? Huawei is a terrible corporation. It's state, yeah. That's Chinese state-owned.
A lot of them are.
And all of them are, right? Because it's a communist country. And Huawei is terrible. Folks, if you got any Huawei stuff hooked up to your computers or you've got a Huawei cell phone, get rid of it. They're listening. They're honestly listening to everything that you're saying.
I have heard that. I've heard that also with a name of a router company called TP-Link. Now, I don't know how true it is.
Anything that has Huawei components in it is really bad. And the cyber capabilities of China are very sophisticated.
Yes, they are.
And it's getting increasingly difficult to even detect penetrations. Before, we could pick up penetrations very, very easily. Now it's getting really hard to pick this stuff up. And... you know, the problem I have with China, you know, with the government, right? I'm speaking to government now, is that they have made a national decision probably about 10 years ago to they want to be at the top of the economic food chain.
Right.
And I think they set that goal. It's 2049. And you look at the Silk Roads Initiative in China and Africa, and everything is speaking toward this. They have just poured all their assets into doing this. Well, what they're doing is they conduct industrial espionage, and they have zero respect for intellectual property rights. Right. So they're backward engineering a lot of this technology and putting it to their advantage, and not investing the research and development dollars that a lot of the Western countries have committed to coming up with this technology on their own. and they're just copying this stuff, and they're not give to they're not giving any due consideration to the entrepreneurs or to the bodies that have developed this intellectual property, and all of a sudden Huawei pops on the scene, you know, about 3 or 4 years ago, and that is a global corporation, every bit as powerful as Microsoft.
Yeah, it is. Now, if I remember correctly, the U.S. government has forbidden them to.
Oh yeah, for very good reason. I just told you the reason. Yeah, because the United States government and the U.S. government went to its allies and said, "You shouldn't do this." Even though these components are less expensive and work really well, sure. Because see, what the Chinese don't lack, we lack patience as Americans, right? We lack mm-hmm. patience, right? And think of it, we're in this rap, fast food, video culture, right? We lack patience, immediate gratification. The Chinese don't, okay? We lack the resources, the personnel resources to analyze this data, this voluminous amount of data that will come in. If you're hoovering up literally everything that you're coming across, okay? Sooner or later, I have a saying, even a blind squirrel trips across a nut every once in a while in the forest. So if you are hoovering up, if your espionage capability, your cyber capability is hoovering up all this data because of backdoors that you're building into these systems, you're going to start tripping across all these nuts that, you know, these little gems out there in the woods. Sure. that we're laying around. Because you have built this system that will allow you to do that. So that really is the danger, right? I go back to the 79 invasion, right, as an example. Different cultures think differently. 79 invasion, we lose the embassy in Tehran. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
sure.
During the Iranian embassy takeover, right? Yep. Well, we had we didn't have cross-cut shredders then, right? This is amazing, right? We had single-cut shredders, all right? Here's the reason we have cross-cut shredders now. Because when they're breaching the embassy and the CIA office is destroying all the source documents, right, all their informant documents, right, they're running them through this cross-cutting shredder, they're literally arrested in the act of jamming these big source files down the shredder. And what the Iranians did is they took all that shredded material and they put their Revolutionary Guards together, taping these
things together.
Yes, that's exactly what they did. And a lot of people got killed when all this information was finally exposed and analyzed and then exposed. So different cultures think differently. And you know the Chinese don't lack labor; they don't lack that.
They have what, almost five times our population.
Oh yeah. And India doesn't either. Thank God, India is our ally.
Yeah, they've got more like almost triple our population.
Thank God, India is an ally. But yes, the Chinese do not lack labor. Right, they have a lot of people, and hence the old expression: never get involved in a land war in Asia. Right.
Yeah.
So it's just a lot of soldiers, right? You know, I go back to the Korean War. You know, the first day that the Chinese came across the Yula River, they came across with 24 divisions. The second day, they came across the war with another 24 divisions. Right? Think about that. 48 divisions in 2 days crossing Yula River. That's a lot of soldiers. Yeah. So anyway, case in point is they don't lack. Personnel resources, all right? So they can have huge analytical parties putting all this hoovered information up that they've collected and trying to find the gems in there. And they will do it if it takes them 100 years.
I've heard of this. I've heard it called a human flesh search engine.
You say that again?
A human flesh search engine. You know, and you have people that just kind of... Remember, China being an authoritative society, the government can say, you are going to work on this.
There is some really, yeah. So that's exactly what they do. And, you know, the other thing is, you know, so China is all about making sure the nation is number one.
Right.
Not necessarily that the individual. See, we're a little bit different culturally. We look at individualism as being very, right. very important.
We want to be number one.
Right. The Chinese, not so much, right?
Right.
The government will say, yes, you know, you're important to us, but you have to sacrifice right now.
Right.
And, you know, for the good of future generations. So we expect you to do this. You're absolutely correct. But you're correct. And it's there's a different cultural thought process. And that's the important thing I want to try to get out. And they are a real competitor, economic competitor, military competitor. They are a real competitor. Mm-hmm. And they bear watching. Huawei is a bad company. I'm glad Huawei is banned in this country for obvious reasons. But that's the reason why, because, you know, and, you know, listen, you can Google this information yourself and read all about it. You know, don't
True.
Take my word for it. Read all about it.
But in our last couple of minutes, just as a for instance, there are American companies that hoover up an awful lot of information as well. Amazon, Facebook, Microsoft, Google, you know, let's face it, they have these
but
products we use are free, and we pay for them by using our personal
information.
But
the thing with American companies, the United States, American companies in the United States is a bit more altruistic than other countries. So sure, I've heard that argument before, right? Well, you know, we do it too, right? Yes, we do. But not to the extent that is going on in China, number one. And two, we better hope that we stay at the top of the economic food chain, right? That's all there is to it, because we are much more altruistic.
And to be honest, it's the American ego. You know, for the last 75 years, we have been the world's number one superpower.
We have been.
And it would be a sea change to find out that we are now the number two superpower, you know, behind China. And I'm not saying we are. I'm just saying that if things keep up the way they're going, it's not out of the realm of possibility.
I think it was President Reagan said, you know, we're only one generation away from losing democracy.
Yeah.
And he's absolutely right. And so, again, I'll leave you and the listeners with this. You know, I understand that, you know, in the world of international politics, it can be, you know, it can be grisly, it can be cutthroat, and there's not a lot of nice things that happen, and all of that is true. But the average American out there, it really behooves them to make sure that we stay at the top of the economic food chain. It really does, because at least the United States is altruistic, right? We're all about fairness. And if somebody says, oh, no, that's not true, you know, the United States, really? Okay, you want China calling the shots? You want Russia calling the shots? Okay, be my guest. And that's what I'll just leave you with.
Okay. It is 1 o'clock. Chief, as always, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Appreciate it. All right, news is next on WASR.